Hello, welcome to this episode of Talking Ghana. Talking Ghana is a podcast devoted to the left, right, and center of Ghana's politics. For each episode, my friends Nelson, Otin, Mami, Oliver, and I offer our refreshingly opinionated and highly controversial take on the key issues and themes shaping Ghanaian politics. I am Papa Dankwa, an international human rights and labor lawyer, and a happy co-host of this podcast. Okay, welcome to this episode of Talking Ghana. I am Papa Dankwa. Our colleague Mami is unable to join us for this episode, but I'm sure Mami will share her views on the topics we are intending to discuss today whenever she's able to join. So let me check up with you guys. How have you been? How are you doing?
We are recovering from election 2020.
The US election, you mean?
Yeah.
How do you recover from something which is not over?
Oh. that's a smart one there. That's a really good one there. But you could say now the tensions have decreased a little bit. So it's a kind of recovery.
Fall Sunday, and we are still anxious about COVID in New York, but fortunately, the cases are a little bit manageable compared to the other parts of the US. But it's a beautiful Sunday and I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, it's raining here in Belgium, as if that's news. Oliver, what's going on in the UK?
Well, for the first time, it's not raining in the UK. So, or at least where I am in Cambridge. But it's a good day as well. I stepped out today and went to do a couple of rounds, and It's a warmer day. I was expecting it to be colder, but it's pretty warm actually.
Yeah, maybe there's some climate change, something happening. Anyway, yeah. In this episode, we will discuss the issue of corruption as part of the election issues relating to the upcoming December 7th elections in Ghana. Elections have always played a big role in Ghana's politics. But in this episode, I want us to discuss this from the perspective of two recent cases which have far-reaching implications for both the fight against corruption, and then for governance, constitutional governance in Ghana. So the first case is the directive the president gave the Auditor General somewhere around 29 June for him to proceed on his accumulated leave. No, so this directive came when the Auditor General was in the middle of auditing a controversial expenditure the executive had done. The second case is the issuance of a corruption and anti-corruption risk report by the Office of the Special Prosecutor. So this is related to the gold royalties monetization transaction under the Ijapa deal. Let me just put it that way. The key question, if that is it, is for me, is whether these two cases create some kind of national level independent super accountability institution whose functions and administration is insulated from the possibility of executive interference, and whether that's the way to go. And are there any blind sides to this? Are there implications for this for the 2020 elections in particular? That's how I'm looking at the discussion on corruption today. What do you guys think?
This matter in the Supreme Court is a better strategy fighting against corruption, or using this as a political tool to campaign and mobilize against his removal in some form of protest, all right? To mobilize against his removal so that that protest or that mass mobilization could be a warning to the authorities that be. So I'm not too sure litigating it in the Supreme Court. Supposing, for instance, you have a bench of the Supreme Court that thinks that it is the right thing to do, then the president is justified in asking him to proceed on leave. Uh-huh. Then you have that decision crystallize, unless the Supreme Court in, at some point in the future depart from that. The goal of having, creating some independent institution or some supranational independent institution, as we you describe it, will not be achieved if that is what we are seeking for the Auditor General. A decision by the Supreme Court justifying the approach by the president will crystallize that, cast it in stone, and the only time you can challenge that again will be maybe another 4 years, another 5 years, that some president will come and do the same thing or something similar will happen and you go to the Supreme Court and ask the Supreme Court to depart from that decision. That is a very difficult thing. I am wondering whether as a strategy, I think that as a strategy, that's what I believe, if civil society could have mobilized around this and say, let some masses protest against this, and 2 months away from elections, a month away from election, that is something that the executive and the authorities will respond to better than going to the Supreme Court to litigate the matter.
I don't know whether I intervene here. I don't know, because it seemed to me that when Papa had asked the question, he was also asking more generally as to whether, in terms of how we approach the conversation on corruption,
exactly,
these two matters are sufficient to deal with into it. But then Otten has also taken the conversation another angle, which is inherently exciting to me, and I'm going to resist the edge, at least in the first instance, and then I'll jump back on that. I think the conversation about corruption itself in Ghana is a difficult one to talk about, because it almost feels like there's always nothing new there, right? Like it's been such a part and parcel of our system of governance that approaches to talking about it, it's difficult to choose one. The two issues you've chosen definitely give us an insight into how we can have a corruption conversation as it pertains to these elections that we're going into, and then exhaust it from that angle. But it shouldn't also preclude us from talking about so many other things, right?
Yes,
like,
yes.
Like a thing talked about, for instance, the death of the former president, Jerry John Rawlings. We know his own legacy and issues in relation to corruption. As a side note, I always used to joke that one of the things about corruption in Ghana is that we've tried to deal with corruption in so many angles. At some point, we line people up and shot them at stake. And that brings to mind Jerry. And then at some other point, we've tried jailing former ministers. We've tried almost everything under the sun as regards corruption itself. So yeah, I think that we can just jump on these two, and that would be enough.
I mean, for me, and let me just also kind of recognize the passing of the former president Jerry Rawlings as well. I mean, it's a really sad episode, but since we are talking about this, our corruption, let me just bring, you know, start from him, his legacy on the issue. Every time we have had a coup d'etat in Ghana, the prime basis for the coup has been some form of a corruption case against the governing elite. This is epitomized by Rawlings' intervention in June 4th, and then later in 79. But this is how I see that, this is how I characterize that. So that is the kind of savior approach to corruption. So one man, strong man, you know, has the moral grounding, makes the case, comes, shoots everybody who he believes is corrupt, as a way of dealing with corruption. So this is the savior approach. And then since we came under constitutional governance since 92, it appears because we created constitutional institutions to address corruption, like say SRAJ, Auditor General's Office, it appears we were shifting from the savior approach to dealing with corruption to a more institutional approach, which perhaps would have hopefully provided some kind of embedded long-term approach to addressing, you know, the corruption issue. What I see with the case being made in the Auditor General's issue is that the argument is the Auditor General, it appears to me, and this is where my confusion is, the Auditor General ought to be insulated from any executive control, even when the executive control does not come in or interfere in his in the performance of his functions. And it appears to me that we think that as civil society, we think that any form of executive interference, whether administrative or directly in relation to his role, is something that is wrong, that would undercut the corruption fight, and he must be the Office of Auditor General must be protected from it. So this suggests to me, I'm not able to, and you guys should correct me, I'm not able to locate this in the current constitutional governance we've practiced for since 92. So this would appear to me a third approach to addressing corruption, not just creating the institutions, but now protecting the institutions from all forms of executive interference, not only executive interference in the direct performance of, say, the Auditor General's functions. Yeah, so this is kind of where I am in the case in relation to the Auditor General or the new angle I kind of see.
But just if I could come in, what would be your remedy for an Auditor General who violates the Constitution, for instance?
Because
it appears in this case, the president's
intervention. I thought you were prompting yes. That it might be good to share some thoughts on Rawlings then before we jump into the conversation. But now okay. You've brought like a okay. substantive point, which might bring even more
no, so that's a direct response. What if we go for an entity that is insulated from executive or political interference? My question is, what happens if the person who occupies that office? Because I think in this case, perhaps a distinction has to be made between the Auditor General as an entity, the whole department, and the Auditor General as a person who occupies that office. So the question that I'm asking is, what happens if that person, in this case, the Auditor General, is violating the Constitution as the president determined, and who will be in charge of overseeing that person?
So Kwame, it looks as if the argument here will be that, and caveat is, I'm not necessarily supporting it, but the argument here will be that there is a way then to deal with it constitutionally. And constitutionally, if you categorize the Auditor General as falling within the category of offices so insulated as you describe, and very analogous to judges of the Superior Court, then there is a way that you go about it. There has to be a petition. The petition goes to the president. The president refers it to the Chief Justice. The Chief Justice then establishes a prima facie case. And if there is a prima facie case, a committee of five is set up, including two or three judges. Correct me, those of you that are so steeped in constitutional law. And then the committee investigates the matter. They make a decision. And based on the decision, the president implements the recommendations without having a discretion in relation to it. That, it would appear, will be the procedure to follow. But the question is, the question then you ask is very important. Until such a time that someone brings a petition, who then administers or supervises the Auditor General? Is it the board? That will be one view. Or it is the president? That will be another view. Or what at all has been stipulated in the conditions of service? And here, perhaps Papa is the guru in labor law. The specific matter that came up is that the Auditor General had accumulated his leave. That seemed to be the factual basis around the president asking him to proceed on that accumulated leave. So there are bigger questions as to what is the purpose of even leave? Why do people, workers have to go on leave? Does it also go to be a governance issue? There are even issues about certain officials similar to the Auditor General accumulating leave so that on retirement, that leave is commuted to cash and becomes a drain on the coffers. All these are big issues that are out there that must be addressed. And so who is the person in the right position to address that? Is it the president? And for those who say it's the president, there's a counter argument that it's not every officer that has to be accountable to the president. And that's where Professor Kwesi Frempeh's conception of an imperial president being dangerous to our nation comes in. So there are issues, but then the bottom line to answer you is that the argument will be that the constitutional procedure for removing him from office or addressing any such thing is well laid out. But then the question is, if you are not removing him from office and there's a lower punishment, for instance, or the lower sanction, for instance, how do you go about that? And who is supposed to do that?
So without exposing my ignorance about, you know, matters of law.
No, I mean, I think this is just...
Yeah,
you know, governance issue.
Yeah, I just want to say a couple of things. It appears there's a lot of noise around the president's move to ask the Auditor General to proceed on leave. And of course, within the noise is substance. And Otin, you've done very well in laying out the substance. The substance of it is that the Auditor General, in this case, accumulated leave. And there seemed to be quite a compelling case for asking the Auditor General to proceed to take the accumulated leave. We don't know what will happen when he exhausts his accumulated leave, whether he'll be allowed to get back. But I think here is a case where the noise tends to get louder for very good reasons. Remember, the Auditor General was appointed at very difficult, very controversial circumstances when it was a lame duck period when Mahama had lost and he was leaving, and he decided to appoint the Auditor General. I remember that raised quite a lot of questions. The NPP were furious that they were coming to power and the president decided to appoint him. And since assuming the office, everybody would acknowledge that the Auditor General has been quite effective in pursuing a fair balance, but in sometimes ways that make the incumbent MPP government uncomfortable. And we can't also lose sight of the fact that the president asks the Auditor General to proceed to take the leave at a time when he was conducting a very important investigation about the senior minister. And so when you look at the noise, it's noise, but it's quite loud and quite compelling. And I think that that is where those constitutional issues and questions that Papa raised at the beginning are very important, because this is clearly what the framers of the Constitution wanted to avoid, which is the instruments of executive power not being deployed to undercut independent institutions of corruption when they are undertaking very important investigation. But I really don't know how you resolve that. I think broadly, there's quite a lot to be said about our willingness as a country to create institutions without really reflecting on how we are going to make those institutions work. And bringing it to the 2020 election, if you look at the two party manifestos, there's quite a lot of new institutions that we have to prepare for. If either of them come to government, the NPP, the NDC is promising what they call Operation Sting, which they are going to launch as part of their Integrity for Development Action Plan, which they launched a while ago, and creating a financial and intelligence center for anti-corruption, and so many other new things. I think as a country, we haven't been very good at, resourcing and giving substantive meaning to the independence that we attach to these anti-corruption institutions.
And you are spot on. That is reflected again for argument's sake. It's reflected in the timing of asking him to proceed on leave. Even if, let's assume for a moment that the president is justified in asking any Auditor General to proceed on leave, is the president permitted to exercise that executive function, however justified, at a time that such an important investigation that seemed to be not so friendly to a very senior minister in government is taking place?
So there's a lot being said, and there's so much I disagree with between what Nelson and Nottin have said that it's difficult to pick up one. I think that perhaps the overriding one is that I do not think that the issue of the Auditor General, as we know it, reflects any frailties or failures in the constitutional framework as we have it as it regards the office. And so the fact that the executive has taken an action which is now evoking a lot of sentiment, that does not necessarily imply that we have a framework which is weak and that is allowing this to happen. Mm-hmm. So let's think a bit carefully, and perhaps it can come down to basics here. So a lot of times when you have what we call difficult constitutional cases, it's where maybe the written law as it exists in the document we have runs out and we have to innovate. But as regards this office and as regards the issue we are dealing with, I don't think that law as it exists those limits exist. So perhaps to build the conversation, to have a better sense of it, I'll just go back again, refer to the Constitution. Because there are two ways in which the Constitution contemplates independence of institutions we create. One, it either uses the language that the institution would be, shall be independent and only subject to the Constitution, or it says it shall not be subject to the direction or control of any other person than those prescribed under the Constitution or under law. Now, this does not imply, we know that this exists for the Office of the Auditor General and also the Electoral Commission and the Judiciary. This does not imply that the Constitution contemplates no checks or balances, or that contemplates that these people cannot be, that the actions of the person cannot be subject to anybody reviewing those actions. One of the things Otin mentioned, for instance, was that when the Auditor General in the performance of his or her functions, then who is the Auditor General subject to? The question is answered by the Constitution. The Constitution makes it clear that the person who exercises oversight over the Auditor General is Parliament. So the Constitution is clear on this point. So you're suggesting, for instance, the board. The board itself includes the Auditor General. So the board cannot exercise oversight over the Auditor General. The board is a board of the audit service and not over the Auditor General itself.
That's true.
So the question here in this particular case is whether or not the president had the authority under the Constitution to direct the Auditor General to proceed on leave. Now we can go into the motives, and perhaps that's what Nelson is calling noise, as to the motives of why the president might take such an action. But the basic question itself needs to be answered. Does the president have the authority under the Constitution to direct the Auditor General to proceed on it? By reference to the Constitution, I would argue that that power does not exist. It does not imply that the Auditor General is an office that is subject to no checks and balances. The two different things. And I also don't want to get into the motives of whether taking leave or not taking leave might be appropriate or not. I don't want to get into that, because also that's a different conversation which is contentious in itself. So we need to answer the questions for ourselves, whether or not the president has the authority and the mandate to ask the Auditor General to proceed on leave.
But Oliver, before you continue, yeah. You can't answer yeah. that question in a rigid silo. And yeah. you can't do that because what is at stake, i.e. the yeah. concept of leave, the practice over time of accumulated leave.
Yeah.
And of course, the timing as well. It's yeah. all part of a broader governance issue, which is not entirely different from corruption as a concept. So if you are answering that question and trying to answer that question in silo, and don't get me wrong, yeah. I am not saying that the president is right.
Yeah.
All that the three of us have expressed in a particular way is that there are these institutions and these public offices that we have created to be independent. In the broader governance issue, including corruption, all right, who are these people accountable to? So if it is Parliament, yes, then Parliament has not been doing its job. But it's very...
I don't think it's correct either. I'll let you go on. But I want to answer two questions. I'm not implying that the conversation as to the relevance of this conversation as regards its role in checking corruption is not important. But I'm thinking that this particular question ought to be answered in silo. And I'll give you a reason why. If I should ask you a question, who has the power to appoint a minister? It should be a question you can answer easily, which is that the president has the power to appoint a minister.
Mm-hmm.
You answering this question, it's not discounting the role of ministers in our constitutional framework. It's not discounting all other conversations we can have. But we should be able to pinpoint certain questions and have answers to them. And if those answers are provided, let's have them and then reflect on what the person has done in a broader context. But I think that we are conflating the issues if you're unable to provide an answer to something quite specific. That if the president, if there's nobody, for instance, or if there's nobody who can direct a minister, if there's issues with leave, does it mean that the president ought to direct members of parliament to proceed on leave? That's, you're turning the whole issues upside down. by mixing up the purpose and the reasoning behind
also
the institution.
So maybe just a quick follow up. Which institution is in charge of monitoring or supervising, whatever language is appropriate, the leave conditions of the Office of the Auditor General?
And perhaps broadly, the persons we describe constitutionally as independent.
But I think that is this. Okay, so Oliver, go on.
No, you go ahead. And then I'll jump in.
I think that is where I agree with some part of Oliver's arguments, because that question is it's a very broad question. And ordinarily, when there's no problem, perhaps they have an internal way of dealing with the issue of leave. So it's either through their boards or through their HRs. There is an institutional way within the audit service, within SRAJ, within, you know, all these organizations where leave is administered. I mean, we have had auditor generals for forever in our governance system in the country, and you know, the issue of leave has always been dealt with. But this comes in because there appears to have been some power struggle going on because of some work that auditor general was doing, and an exertion of an executive power as kind of to address a perceived gap, you know, in a conflict between the auditor general and the presidency or the executive. And I think that becomes for me because it's exercise of power. So that is how I would look at it, the exercise of power, and whether the exercise of power. So I would isolate this exercise of power from the ordinary running of the administration, you know, in terms of HR and so on.
Fair.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, Oliver.
So I was coming to say, so you had asked the question about who determines questions of leave and such. And I'll say that generally the question about leave is left to law, that the Labor Act clearly states entitlement to leave. Now, under none of our rules, there's no institution that has a control to direct anybody to go on leave, whether it is the president himself or herself, whether it's the chief justice, whether it's the head of the Electoral Commission or anybody. Nobody has been given the authority to direct another person to go on leave. That's generally the general position of the way in which our framework works. Now, we have to think about even the way in which the labor law approaches it. It approaches it as a question of a right, that a person has a right to take leave. There's nothing limiting any institution. The public service has done this, civil service has done this, saying that if leave is not taken within a particular time frame, it is forfeited. There's nothing precluding anybody from requiring that leave within a particular year be taken within that year. And the civil service has done that itself. So that's the general framework of the leave conversation. So that's why I am cautious about. I want us to have a conversation about the significance of what the president has done, but I don't want us to make it seem as if the leave issue is in controversy and that justifies everything.
Papa, you've written about this.
Yes.
And my reading of what you wrote is a bit different from what Oliver is saying. So if you could
because if we don't take it, this conversation will become a leave conversation. And I think even in my write-up on CTFM, I tried to distinguish the two issues to say, look, I am in no way trying to discuss the constitutional governance issues related to the actions of the president. I just wanted to address an issue that was raised in relation to taking of leave for feature of leave purported to be coming from an HR aspect, which I thought could create a wrong impression of what the law is on leave. And I think,
but it's all right. But it's all right if it becomes a leave issues, and listeners and followers will understand that will constitute part one of this broader thing. Because
no.
Because that is is actually also a broader governance issue that is important to be addressed.
Okay, so just a bit of a pushback again. I think the leave question is very important in this issue, because remember, the president has not fired the Auditor General.
He
just asked him to take his accumulated leave. And that is why I was making that distinction between the noise or the perception around it and the substance. For me, the substance on paper is that the president has directed the Auditor General to proceed to take his accumulated leave. He hasn't fired him. Of course, we know from the news and his office logs being changed and all that, that is where the president is going. But it will be quite interesting to see when the time is exhausted and the Auditor General decides to return to work. But I think we can't also discount that bit. And if there is a problem with, as Oliver is suggesting, if there is a problem with even the leave governance structure, then that reinforces that noise, the perception of executive interference a bit more. And that is why I think for our listeners and also for a non-legal person like me, clarity of whether that move that the president has made is in itself warranted legally.
I think that, and Oliver, sorry, I'll just let you go, come back a little. I think that, so Oliver was saying that it's Parliament which has supervisory jurisdiction over the work of the Auditor General. If, in my view, for any administration of, broadly speaking, I think that is an executive action. So if my view is correct, then if there's a conflict between the Auditor General and the executive, say the presidency, in terms of his leave arrangement as part of his contract, you know, his contract issues, I think ultimately the head of state as an executive will have to make the call. The question for me is whether the head of state in making the call complied with administrative law provisions under, say, Article 23 or 24, if my memory is right, and whether he consulted the Auditor General, he acted based on the governance within the audit service, and so on. So for me, that is how I would look at it. And if the president erred by not complying with administrative law compliance requirements, then the president erred and must be brought to book through law. I see where Oliver's argument is in relation to Parliament, but I thought that was a very circumscribed role for Parliament in relation to the expenditure of the audit service and also the expenditure of the country as a whole. I did not see the provision in relation to the administration of public services, generally speaking. And also how public service functions in relation to implementation of contractual agreements and so on.
Right. So I think the first point I want to make is, first of all, I disagree with the way in which you framed sort of the constitutional arrangement of powers, where it seems to be that where there's power which has not been ascribed to any particular person or any of this thing, it lodges in the person of the president,
the head of state.
I think that is an undemocratic way of viewing the constitutional framework. The powers of the president are clearly laid out, and I think that where power has not been clearly mobbed up or assigned, the constitution makes it clear that is given to Parliament. And the Parliament has the right to legislate in areas where power has not been particularly ascribed to anybody. So those are the non-specifically given powers. So the president cannot cannot claim powers except powers which have been specifically named under the Constitution. That's the way in which our constitutional framework is set up.
But Oliver, let Oliver finish. Oliver must finish because I think he has been interrupted too much.
Okay, all right, Oliver, please go on.
So that's the general point I want to make, that there's no room within the Constitution for the president to assert powers which have not been given to the president. Else we end up creating a beast we cannot control. There's so much issues within our Constitution that the Constitution does not ascribe to anybody else. And the Constitution makes it clear that those powers are given to Parliament to legislate on. To claim then that power exists in the president, whereas the president walks about and see a hungry civil servant and decides that take 2 days off to go and eat. It doesn't work that way. Or we are creating a different beast. But let's come to the question of the leave specifically and why I think that we need to isolate it. I agree that the conversation about whether or not to ask that Auditor General to go on leave, it's an interesting question on its own. And we can have that conversation. And why I wanted us to segment the conversation is that it seemed that we are suggesting that there's a lack of clarity about leave. And so this needs to be brought up into the whole framework and discussion about the utility of the move and how leave is proper or not proper and whether or not the president doing this is trying to undermine the office or not. I don't want us to confuse the two things. When it comes to leave as regards this particular thing, like Nelson said, what are the issues? The issue is that by a letter on, I think, the 20th of what date, the president directed the Auditor General to proceed on leave. That's the first thing. The question then becomes, does the president, as we know it, have the authority under our Constitution to direct the Auditor General to go on leave? That's a separate conversation. We can have that conversation. So that when we conclude that it is, for instance, if we conclude that it's unclear if anybody can direct the Auditor General to go on leave, then we can have a second conversation as to whether it is proper then for the president to exercise that power regarding the way in which what the office stands for in a constitutional governance. So that when we separate these two issues, we can then have a conversation that is rich and proper. That's my general framework.
I will still push back and say that separation is not it's not going to be helpful. I think you need to answer for me and for our listeners. Yeah. Does the president have the authority to direct the Auditor General to take his or her accumulated leave?
First, let me talk about accumulated leave. Because it seems almost as if there's something nefarious about accumulated leave, especially the way we're talking. All leave is accumulated. The way the Article 20, Section 20 of the Labor Act says it, that you don't get leave in anticipation. You have to have, it comes after you have accumulated it.
We say accrued.
Right. So accrued leave is what you are calling accumulated. So all leave is accrued or accumulated. But on the specific question you are asking, the president has no authority, under no law, to direct the Auditor General to proceed on leave.
And this is where I disagree with you. And Papa, you have to speak.
Exactly.
You have to, at some point, speak to the issue about the concept of leave and what it is for. It's very, very important because
let me answer the purpose of the leave does not ascribe the president powers. Let me make that clear.
Exactly.
When you say that you disagree with me, you have to state clearly where that power comes from. Don't claim that the purpose and the reason gives the president some authority.
And I may be mistaken here. The power, I think.
No. There's no room for being mistaken. You have to be factually correct when you answer this.
The power, I think, comes from the procedure and the processes in determining the conditions of service and emoluments for Article 70 office holders. All right. A committee is set up.
Article 71, okay.
Yeah, Article 70, 71. All right.
Yeah.
If it will be a grave omission if in the report of the commission determining what will be the emolument and privileges of Article 70 office holders, nothing is said about their leave and leave conditions. As a matter of fact, in practice, all those office holders, when they are taking their leave, and correct me if I'm wrong, actually notifies the office of the president that they are proceeding on leave. All those office holders. Mm-hmm. What's the purpose for that?
Do you want to read more into the notification than notification?
Notification.
For people who are listening, let's listen to the argument Otin is making. Otin's claim is that because of Article 71, which directs that the...
Oliver, Otin must finish his argument.
Let him read Article 17.
And privileges available. And listen to the offices that are listed. The Speaker and Deputy Speaker and Members of Parliament. One, meaning that by Otin's argument, the President can direct the Speaker, Deputy Speakers, and Members of Parliament, entirety of them, all at the same time, to go on leave. Two, the Chief Justice and other Justices of the Superior Court of Justice. By Otin's argument, the President, if this is where Otin is locating the power, can direct the Chief Justice and all Justices of the Superior Court to go on leave at any point in time. The Auditor General, and this is where the Auditor General comes in, the Chairman and Deputy of the Electoral Commission, of SHRAJ, the Chairman, Vice Chairman of the National Council for Higher Education, the Public Services Commission, the National Media Commission, and the Lands Commission and the National Commission for Civic Education. Otin's argument that because there's a facility where the president would appoint a committee to advise him for determining the emoluments of these persons, the president then gains a power to direct all these people to go on leave. By the same extension of that argument, the determination of the salaries, allowances, and facilities of the president, vice president, the council of state, ministers of state, is determined by parliament and also on the recommendation of the committee, meaning that the parliament can direct the president and the vice president to go on leave, can direct the chairman and the members of the council of state to go on leave, and direct all ministers of state to go on leave. That is the argument Otin is making.
No. So you got to, when you read the constitution like that, and that's not how I am reading the constitution.
Please read it the way you want to read it, so that it is clear for everybody on. Because I don't want them to muddy the waters from this conversation.
So in other parts of the constitution, certain offices and certain bodies have been carved out. Two of such bodies will be the parliament speaker, and another will be the judiciary. Okay?
Exactly. They are clearly
carved out.
Yeah.
Now the rest of the institutions you have read, all right? Go to Article 190.
Which institution do you say have been carved out?
Those exercising some kind of executive authority. Those
are not in the legislative,
judiciary. Yeah.
Legislative power, and those exercising.
So let's say the parliament, there's a provision on legislature, for instance, one. Mm-hmm. You see, this is nothing. I don't know whether the conversation is interesting to you, because it comes down to whether or not we are properly reading the document, the constitutional document. And I don't know whether that's the conversation.
I think it would be helpful if you are more specific, because I at the moment, Oliver, yeah, what you are doing is you are also pulling a lot of straws. The question is, in this case, and I will still ask the question again.
Yes.
Does the president have the authority to ask the auditor, specifically the auditor general, to take his accumulated leave? And if your argument is that the president does not have the authority, then who has the authority? Because from my layman's perspective, I will reject the fact that that is from parliament, because the only way parliament will exercise that right will be generally or mostly through laws and certain regulations that they will pass.
Yes.
So who has, and this is, please be very specific. Lawyers have a way of confusing all of us.
Oh, no. We are enlightening you.
But the question, I've answered again. that the president has no authority to direct the Auditor General to proceed on leave.
So
that's
who
my answer to it.
So he's
saying that.
Kwame Nelson, his answer simply, there's a provision in there, it's a residual powers provision in the Constitution.
Yes.
So what essentially what it is that if there is anything that is not clearly provided for, then Parliament must provide for it. So it's that simple. So what he's saying...
It's not simple for me because.
So what I'm saying is that
Parliament has Parliament made provision for that.
No.
The complimentary question has not directed is, it doesn't mean that the president gains the authority. So that's the one I want to separate.
But nobody's saying that.
President has no authority to direct the Auditor General to go on leave.
So who
the president has no power?
Who has that?
Nobody has the authority to direct the Auditor General to go on leave. Otin says he disagrees with my point that the president does not have the authority. And I'm asking for him to locate that where the president gets the authority. He located it in Article 70 and Article 71. And I pointed out that that article applies to all the institutions I've listed. So Otin's argument by extension is that everybody within that language would then be subject to the president directing them to go on leave. And vice versa, Parliament can also direct the president to go on leave.
My simple response to you is that Parliament, the Speaker of Parliament, Judiciary, Chief Justice, they've been clearly carved out and provided for under the various chapters that the Constitution deal with. Can I just finish and make a point?
I'll let you make that point. Then. But by the same token, the Auditor General's Office is also carved out and dealt with separately under the Constitution. So I don't know what you're getting from
how
that.
How does it... you answer and then I'll come in a question.
But you see, the rest of the institutions, when you go to what constitutes the public service, all right?
Yeah.
You've got to start from there. Constitute the public service and the Constitution gives the president that power generally as the person who will have general oversight over the public service, for the public service. In practice, he does that. Various presidents does that through different boards.
So the institution,
the Public Service Commission comes in, the boards of the various institutions come in. Audit service actually is specifically listed as being part of the public service. Let me finish. I know where you're going.
Let's not confuse audit service, the audit service and auditor general.
The reason why I'm forced to jump in
is that there may be lay audiences.
We are making this too much of talking over.
The simple thing I am saying that the rest of the institution that have not been specifically carved out, all right? The person that can do such administrative things will be the president of Ghana. He is that person that people have elected and given the mandate to do all these things.
The Constitution does not contemplate the election of a king. The Constitution contemplates the election of somebody who is bound by law, who is subject to law. So to tell me that we have elected a president who is supposed to administrate the country, which implies that he has authority to do whatever law does not define.
Oliver,
that's what he's saying.
He's not saying who is supposed to administrate the country. Who is supposed to exercise executive authority over a period?
Authority, if it is not defined, the executive authority of the president is clearly defined under the Constitution. All the powers the Constitution lists that make up executive authority is clear. It is not a word which is, how do you call it, subject to, is an empty container which we can push it in every direction we want to push it. If that is the argument you want to make, then it's not a conversation that is inherently interesting for me.
So, thanks.
I have a question.
Okay.
What is the harm, what is the prejudice if the if the president has this power, what's the prejudice? What's the harm? And then right. If the Auditor General is insulated from all executive accountability, except of course parliamentary, he has some kind of parliamentary or ultimately some kind of judicial supervision, does this harm us in the fight against corruption in any way?
Very good question, and I think it does.
Absolutely.
In this case, where there appears to be, as you rightly said at the beginning, it's some sort of a conflict between the executive and the office, then the president cannot override the office the way it has done. And just to put a bit of context, since the Auditor General proceeded on leave, the senior minister has been cleared. He was cleared virtually a day after the Auditor General proceeded on leave. And so for me, I think that and that's the point I made about the noise being quite compelling, that it's so obvious to see what is going on that it becomes very difficult to sustain the more substantive point, which the president is trying to make us believe that this is him essentially promoting the welfare of the Auditor General by asking him to take a break. When we know that is not what is going on. And so, yes, to answer your question, I think we lose out a lot if the institutions of accountability and institutions of oversight of various ministries, departments, and agencies are subject to executive manipulation. And in this case, that is what appears to be going on. But I still think that in order to sustain that point, you need to really situate that action in the context of some sort of arbitrary power, which the president has exercised. And it looks like that, I'm more persuaded by Otin's point that it seems that it is an exercise of some legitimate authority, but nonetheless, it still does not deal with the fact that this exercise of that authority is shrouded in some suspicious executive behavior.
Abuse of power.
Exactly.
If you frame it in terms of abuse of his power, it'll be very, very, it will be very persuasive to me. And this is where I fear about this action, because we all know why the president should not, we all will understand why the president should not exercise that power. At a very important point, during a very important investigation, where a very senior personality in government is being investigated. And if then civil society, the way civil society to exercises pressure on government is to go to courts and judicialize this, what I see to be a very political issue. And let's say for the sake of argument, that the Supreme Court then decides that the president is justified. The outcome that civil society is seeking, i.e. the outcome of fighting against that corruption, or better put, that abuse of power by the president, is forever crystallized and is filled. I think that it will be better that civil society marshals its resources, mobilize the masses, create a certain awareness going into our election that this must be an election issue. If we all agree that the Auditor General must be left to do his job, create that public consciousness that this must be an election issue, and hope that the electorate understand you and votes a government out based on this issue.
So you want a more political way of dealing with it?
Let me intervene here. The Kwesotens' way of arguing or saying this thing sounds on the surface nice, but in substance, it's full of straw. First of all, I have made the argument that the president cannot assess any legitimate basis to ask direct the Auditor General to proceed on leave. So this is where we differ, that I don't think that a legitimate basis exists even before we talk about the power being abused. But on a constitutionalism point, if the president did have that authority to make that power, then as a constitutionalist, in terms of constitutional thinking, then I don't think that that power ought to be exercisable in any manner the president chooses, unless we put direct limitations in that power and say that you cannot exercise the power if you are subject of any particular proceedings. So then it becomes clear
I absolutely agree with that.
Okay.
I would absolutely agree with that.
Hold on. That, because this is the thing, that if the president did in fact have the power, there will be conversations about tuning how the power is exercised. I'm saying that power is not even exist, it doesn't exist in the first place. So that the action itself, you know, and by which reason, illegitimate ab initio. Now you are saying that civil societies ought to carry the extra burden of mobilizing people for elections as a way in which we rein in executive over abuse of power. And I think that that's completely inappropriate. You've doubted the reason or the rationale for civil society going to court. But let's think about it in the context in which we are. We have a president who has put in place a law which by its very nature makes it extensive for him to break down any protest based on COVID-19. They're using that same, despite the existence of that legal framework, they are doing up electioneering campaigning. But in terms of protests, we have had institutions which have denied every civil society organization the power to protest during these times. So if we forget the context in which we are, you would think that our team is making a smart argument. But in fact, we are in a COVID situation whereby protest is unexercisable. Secondly, in our democratic experience, how many times has civil society moved people to the streets to come as a way in which to use election as a check for something that the president has done? You have written to the president and advised the president to not to do such an action. The president has sent a letter out claiming that the power exists. In the minds of other people, already they are doubting the legitimacy of civil society speaking up against the issue, because clearly by the president's letter, the power exists. So what are you talking about? Already the basis to mobilize people to go into the street and protest a power that is legitimately exists is a difficult one to assess.
No, but
so what you need to be able to do, and I think in terms of strategy, is to go to court as civil society has done, Oliver,
you are putting again what I've just said in very narrow confines. When I say mobilize and protest, I don't necessarily mean only a street protest. Can we grow as civil society and people who support this? Can we grow to the extent that we can create a certain awareness and make it an election issue?
But it's an either or question.
And what we are doing,
civil society organizations have gone to court. So this mobilization that you are asking for, there's still space. It has not been foreclosed, but it's not happening. So when you're saying this, you're making an either or argument. But that they shouldn't have gone to court, but they should have resorted to mobilization and protest in leading to elections. If you decide to reframe that and say not street-based protest.
All I am saying is that in all the basket of tools, all right, they could use, including litigation, in terms of the timing of this, a few weeks away from election, a better way of going about it would be to, if it's that important, to make it an issue for elections, create awareness about it and hope that the electorate understand it well and vote on it as an electoral issue. That's all I am saying. It doesn't preclude any litigation. It's just a cautionary tale that if you are litigating a matter like this, be prepared that if the matter goes the other way, your goal of stopping the president now has failed and is crystallized, and it will have to take a more difficult process to undo it. That's all I am saying.
Where I agree with Oliver is that the President Kufuor's administration had this kind of tense relationship with the Auditor General. President Mills had tense relationship with the Auditor General, and President Kufuor has had. So perhaps it is about time to clarify, you know, what the president can and cannot do in relation to the functioning or administering of the office of the Auditor General, i.e.
No, but that
contractual
has gone,
relationships.
Remember, that has gone to court.
And, yes, and, we, and I think
Brown
some of the...
Attorney General, sorry for being legalese now. The case of Brown and Attorney General seem to have clearly settled the matter and categorized the Auditor General in the class of judges of the superior courts. All right? And the conditions then apply to it. The question here is then, who is that person who administer the conditions?
Yes, and I think that is what I'm saying. I think it is about time that matter, because I think we can see how the Auditor General's office has been developed through litigation and over time. And recently, the Occupy Ghana, I think it was last 2016, 2017, that the Occupy Ghana went to court to seek some, further clarity on the powers of the Auditor General and so on. I think perhaps this is the route to go to continue to empower the Auditor General for his fight against corruption. Let's turn to the Special Prosecutor now. So the Special Prosecutor...
Has Nelson had his final say on it? He seemed to be wanting to make a point before we go to...
What's gone on in this instance? It is quite clear that we all agree that whether legal or illegal, what the president has undertaken amounts to abuse of office or abuse of power. And you can abuse power from where I stand, even if it is grounded in law. For me, I would rather appeal to some sort of other normative ideals, human rights, fairness, equity, and all that. And I think in this case, it is quite clear to me that this is a move that indicates a certain manipulation of a process that is supposed to be independent, that is supposed to be a much more effective check on executive abuse. And it's unfortunate that it has taken the form it is. And which brings me to the point that Papa made initially about the auditor, the Office of the Special Prosecutor. And for me, it's while celebrating its novelty in Ghana and its potential for promoting effective anti-corruption environment, it also points to a worrying trend, especially considering the context of what Papa laid out in terms of the Auditor General's report about the EJAPA deal. There seemed to be this, and it's not just...
Austin, you mean the Special Prosecutor's report, not
yes.
The Auditor General?
Sorry, the Special Prosecutor's report on the EJAPA deal. And there's been quite a lot of debate about the EJAPA deal, so I don't want to go back into it. But one of the things that I found worrying about the EJAPA deal is this attempt to create authorities that are not subject to any form of oversight. And if you look at the amendments that the government proposed in the EJAPA deal in Parliament, which got everybody upset, one of those amendments was to insulate the special purpose vehicle from the control of the Auditor General and the control of all the processes that we have laid out through our public finance management systems. And it also points to another worrying trend for me, which is this idea that the executive can act despite all the things that we have said about our commitment to anti-corruption and the creation of anti-corruption institution, that we have a process or a certain orientation of the executive to override and undercut the power of these independent anti-corruption institutions through manipulation of legal processes and administrative procedure. And that for me is a worrying thing. And I wish civil society action will not just be focused on establishing the legality or otherwise of what the president has done, but situating it within the broader context of checking executive power, because that is, for me, the main problem.
I do think that there's a bit of that concern in this conversation, because what we have done, and why perhaps I genuinely believe in the genius of going to court on this one, is that for the first time, the judges are being confronted with the question as to whether, if they do recognize an authority of the president to ask the Auditor General to proceed on leave, then they should inherently, by the same argument of thing I made earlier, recognize that, one, it can extend beyond just leave. The president can say a lot more under the name of trying to ensure administrative efficiency. Two, that it goes beyond the office of the Auditor General, but it affects everyone else, the judges themselves included, and the independence of the judiciary itself. Because in terms of administration-wise, the president can also take certain measures regarding whether or not it directs the Chief Justice when a crucial matter comes before the Chief Justice, before the Supreme Court, and it directs judges of the Supreme Court to go on leave. Or that it directs the Electoral Commissioner on a day of election to go on leave. So there's a lot more mischief that can be done. And we should know that, I mean, as rules exist, there's constant avenue for people to continue to want to you know, tinker with the rules in a way in which to secure a certain outcome for themselves. We have already entrusted the democracy to people who at heart are not Democrats. And that's something that we have to contend with as a way in which we have to live our democracy. It's the fact of it. And that's what I think this provides us. It's not just about the dry question about whether or not the president can appoint, but the implications of what it does. And if judges are confronted with this question and then conclude that there's an authority, that the president does have the power to do this, then we should know that we have ceded much more in our democracy than it is. And we have to live with the reality of institutions conniving, one, with parliament itself conniving with the with an executive to create the monster that the Jampa is. And that, two, that we have a judiciary that has also been roped up into this connivance and recognizing the president's authority to do this. Then that's the democratic system we have created for ourselves, and that this mischief that we have elected a president, and the president knows better and cares for us all.
Yes, but
I can see a court, a bench of the court, deciding that the president has the power to do it. But hopefully, let's just hope that even if they do that, all right, they will then circumscribe the power and put constrain it and indicate circumstances where the power, if exercised in a certain direction, can be an abuse of power.
Any comments on the special prosecutor's report and how it implicates the exercise of executive power?
I feel like this is a good place to wrap up this conversation, and then we can continue biting at the special prosecutors in our next episode.
Yeah, that's fine. Agreed.